Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is David Sacks, a Canadian journalist who is a regular contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek and The New Yorker's website. He is the author of the books The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue, and Save the Deli, In Search of Perfect Pastrami, Crusty Rye, and the Heart of Jewish Delicatessen. But he's here today not to talk about expanding our waistlines, but expanding the contents of our bookshelves and pencil cups. His new book, The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter, is out now from Public Affairs Books. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Harry.
So what made you write your third book about pencils and staplers rather than pastries and matzo ball soup?
It started off about a decade ago when two things were happening in my life kind of at the same time. One of them was the introduction of smartphones. And around this time, in 2007, a lot of people I knew were getting BlackBerries. This is, predates the iPhone by about a year. And I just noticed like how instantly people's behavior changed and things that were antisocial suddenly became the norm, right? People would just stop mid-sentence in a conversation and disappear for a while.
Right.
And the other thing that happened at the time was my roommate and I were given a turntable by his parents, who were sort of clearing out their basement, and a bunch of records. And we started listening to records again right around the same time that we had actually just uploaded all of our CDs into iTunes and figured out how to stream them wirelessly through our stereo. At the exact same time, we got this turntable, and yet we were drawn to the records more, and it kind of kicked off this conversation about, how the technology influenced the experience, not just with music, but then this sort of broader conversation that eventually led to what the book's about.
Going back to the story about your dinner with your friends that you mentioned in the book, that's a common complaint that tech has become a distraction, but there are also people who say that the cell phone, the smartphone in particular, is no more a distraction than newspapers were or books, that throughout history, every new technology is seen as a distraction or somehow less than compared to the old technology that it's replacing or trying to replace. But do you agree with that?
To some sense, yes, right? There is truth to that. The sort of highbrow, lowbrow culture argument, I think, falls into that. When you look back at how books were received, paperback books were received, newspapers, magazines, radio, TV, film, it was all this, it will pervert the minds of our youth and make them blind like masturbation. and of course, that didn't happen. I think the difference here, and what I found so significant about it, was that you'd never have a conversation with someone in the middle of a dinner table and they would all of a sudden open up a newspaper and just stop in the middle of it. You would never have that with someone, unless you're at a house where there was a TV in that room. But, suddenly everybody had all those things combined in their pocket, and it was the first time that it really became a personal accessory, right? Prior to that, there was 10 years of the computer and 20 years or 10 years of the internet and, 20 to something years of the personal computer, but they were rooted in a fixed place. You had to be in that part of the house or at work to sort of access it. Now, it was the ubiquitousness of it coupled with its, power, its processing power, its speed, the availability of all sorts of things on that, that set it apart. I think digital devices and digital culture from all those previous analog mediums that were criticized. They were limited in what they could do, and with digital media, it isn't. I mean, I'm talking to you on the same smartphone that I take photos of my kids on, that I check emails 1,000 times a day on, that I could sit on Twitter for hours on, and compose music and do whatever I wanted. I mean, I could theoretically never take this thing away from my eyes,
right?
Which is much harder to do with books or magazines or newspapers or TV.
Right. And it's one reason I really enjoyed reading the book in paper as opposed to on an iPad or a Kindle or anything, because of that level of distraction and the fact that you can do just about anything on these devices that other than reading. But before we go any further, would you mind reading a little bit from the book?
Sure, yeah. This is from the introduction and talking about that, journey into sort of buying records a couple years later, actually. So that was the beginning, and then I moved away. I lived in New York, and then got a turntable given to me by a friend. I've been very lucky in not having to ever buy a turntable.
I know, nice.
Yeah. And the good thing is that, you know, the old ones work, right? You got to pay to fix them up occasionally, but they keep going. So this is, you know, after moving into a new house with my wife, and there was a new record store called June Records that opened just up the street from me here, which I still go to regularly. I found myself purchasing records wherever I could. I began by digging through the discount bins at June Records for old jazz and soul albums, but was very soon buying freshly pressed, newly released records by bands and artists I learned about by actually talking to June's staff. Often, if something was playing on the turntable there, I'd pick it up. The harmonic guitar rock debut from local band Alves, a fresh compilation from Nigerian psych disco hermit William Onyebor, the stripped-back instrumental hip-hop collaboration from Lat legend Ghostface Killah and funk band Bad Bad Not Good. My new collection, which numbered maybe a dozen old records when I moved into the house, swelled so quickly, my wife declared a hard limit on the number of shelves it could occupy. I was having too much fun to care. My modest vinyl fetish had tapped into something that was lying dormant since my first Napster download, the carnal pleasure of physically browsing and buying music. I would walk by a record store, and suddenly the $10 bill in my wallet would begin burning, demanding to be spent. Half an hour later, I would emerge with an album under my arm, my face swollen with pride, as though I had recorded the damn thing myself. In an age when I could have the exact same music for free and play it on 5 different devices, here I was paying good money for scratchy, heavy, cumbersome discs of melted plastic that I had to play in a machine as temperamental and costly to maintain as an old car. It was totally irrational.
Throughout the book, there's talk about all these companies starting up again, these analog businesses based on a love for the product, like Lomography and Project and all these vinyl and notebook and film companies. But in the beginning of the book, around page 44, you say that no one starts a notebook company out of romance or nostalgia. But don't you have to have some kind of romance or nostalgia for the product in order to build an entire business on it?
Well, I don't think what I mean by that is, yeah, you have to have a love for your product, right, and a belief in it. But I think what, you know, people often dismiss the sort of recent growth in vinyl and the other analog goods and ideas that I talk about in the book as, oh, well, that's just nostalgia. These people are just being nostalgic, right? It's just nostalgic hipsters. Mm-hmm. Those are the two terms that people just sort of dismiss it as. And you know, I find that just a foolish kind of dismissive notion where, you know, for businesses like these, which are growing and in many cases, you know, consistently over the course of a decade and profitable, they're not driven and they're not investing in their own businesses or the businesses of others by saying, oh, didn't you love the days of bookstores? Wouldn't it be just great to open it? Let's not worry about money. Let's just go back to those days. Don't you pine for the days of a well-made notebook? You know, there is a market that is growing and has a demand for these goods and services. And so the people who are entering that market as investors, as entrepreneurs, as operators, are not doing it out of some like romantic love for this stuff. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. They see an opportunity there. They see growth. They see a potential that I think for a lot of people, especially in the business community, was not apparent and was sort of dismissed as, you know, moribund, right? That well, everything is digital, and if you're going to make money, it has to be through a digital business, and you have to be building apps in order to do it, or investing in venture capital, that there's no money to be made in making things or selling things or bookstores or brick and mortar retail in generally, right? Right. And what I set out to prove and examine was, look, that's not the case, or that's not the only case. Here's some areas where it's really growing. And I think there was sort of two ways I could have gone with this book, right? One was very much looking at the cultural and, you know, sociological reasons why people are listening to vinyl again and bookstores are opening up again, and what the tactile pleasures are and the, you know, the psychology of the brain. And I touch on that a bit, but I wanted it to be a book about these businesses because it's harder to just bat that off. It's easier to say, yeah, well, none of that matters because it's just nostalgia. You know, who cares? It's like, well, look at the numbers, right? Look how much vinyl record sales have grown. Look how much independent bookstores are expanding in the U.S. over the past 5-6 years. Look at, you know, the growth of Moleskine as a company over the course of the past 20 years. Like, look at that and tell me that this isn't real and this isn't happening.
Well, I mean, they're very vocal, but increasingly growing communities built around these products, not just Moleskine, but there are podcasts about pencils. There are podcasts about pens and collecting. And there are, as you write in the book, there are websites like Moleskinery and Rhodia Drive and all of these different things being built around these objects that people have brought back into the marketplace. Field Notes is a particularly focused one around the, just like Shinola, the watch company that you talk about in the book. They're very big on their story and what they're trying to do and build up by releasing these notebooks that are reminiscent of the old agricultural notebooks from the 30s.
Yeah, and they're really interesting. I spoke to them. You know, they make an appearance in the book. I would have loved to have written more about them, but what Aaron Drabone and Jim Kudla have done, which are the two sort of founders of Field Notes, is again, you know, take a relatively ordinary object, right?
Right.
There's not much new you can do in the world of notebooks. Like, you know, all these companies that are out there selling notebooks, it's all just some twist on a Moleskine, which is in itself just a rebranding of a particular design of notebook. They're, you know, it's pages of paper with a cover, right? All of them essentially do the same thing. And yet what, you know, Field Notes has been able to do very successfully is differentiate itself, build a story around it, make it an object that people want, something that stands out, something that they're willing to pay a premium for, and grow a market that, you know, no one thought would even survive, let alone be an expanding category.
Right. There was a recent Kickstarter project that cropped up, and it was someone had redesigned the composition notebook, and they basically broke down all the elements of a composition notebook and put a very, very design heavy influence into it. And what you end up getting is this $19 composition notebook, which looks like what we all went to school with, but is really nothing like what a composition notebook is supposed to represent. Cheap, taped and stitched binding, and just something you can pick up for a dime at the local drugstore. So I had posed a question because I'm in a Facebook group for the podcast about pencils. I had mentioned the Erasable podcast, and one of the hosts, Andy Welfley, runs a blog about pencils and co-hosts the show. And he had a question, and basically, how do you tell what is a genuine, authentic love of analog and what is essentially hipster fetishism of this antiquated technology? Does it matter that there is a difference?
I don't think so. I mean, to the user, to the person who will take the time to start design a $20 composition notebook, to pay, you know, back the Kickstarter campaign for a $20 composition notebook, who buys the $20 composition notebook or who writes in the $20 composition notebook, who cares? Who the hell cares, right? You know, I think there is this, again, like, there is this unplaced kind of shame around it in a way that's really interesting. No one is questioning why, you know, you would spend $20 on a bottle of wine when you can get wine for, you know, $7 at Trader Joe's or whatever it costs, right? Mm-hmm. No one is questioning why, you know, my brother drives a BMW and I drive a Volkswagen with a cracked front bumper, and like, why isn't he fetishizing the car? I mean, that is our nature in a capitalist consumerist world, right? We create these levels of value in different things, and so if it brings joy to someone, if they feel it helps them in their creative process and their work process, then, you know, what is the economy there for once we're done with sort of basic staples, if not to indulge every fetishization that we have? And I think, you know, those companies in the world of sort of resurgent analog goods that have been successful have been the ones that have been able to tap into that, whether it's, you know, the record companies and you know, that have reissued, you know, 40th anniversary Dark Side of the Moon double box sets for $40, or you know, the Notebook Kickstarter company that's taking some new spin on the same old thing.
Right.
What, there's very little actually that differentiates that. And that's fine. That's great. Right. That's, you know, that's what makes America and the rest of the, and the rest of the consumerist world. So I think like this notion of like, well, the purity of a simple notebook for a lot of people, that's fine. That's great. You know, I don't use fancy notebooks when I'm working. And I think it differentiates for others, right? Some people are happy to write with a, you know, $5 Bic pen, or not even $5 box of Bic pens, and other people, you know, need a Mont Blanc fountain pen or some other sort of,
right,
you know, special thing. I think it's that levels of, you know, levels of consumerism and the different economies that are there.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but there is a part of me that wonders how much of it is an actual love for the product and just how much is capitalizing on this growing community that's willing to spend a lot of money on these things just because they look nice.
Well, but I think the other thing about it too is that, you know, today analog is not the default. It's not the standard, right? The standard is digital, even for something as simple as writing notes. You know, mm-hmm. You want to take a note about something, you have your phone there. It has a note program. You can send it an email to yourself. You can do whatever. And so because of, and it's free or like so cheap that it does, you don't even think about it. Right. And so because of that, you know, in even the most basic sense, you know, analog becomes a luxury. And you know, people are only really indulging in it or buying it or paying money for it because it's something that they want to do, right? It's mm-hmm. something that works for them. It's a choice. It's a conscious choice they're making. And so because of that, you know, the market is sort of based on that fetishization that for, you know, each individual is, you know, that's fine. That's what works for them. So does it matter like that's what's the driving force behind a lot of it? I don't particularly think so. I mean, I know someone was like, well, you know, what about, you know, that this is a middle-class thing, or what about like, you know, the poor, you know, classes, and you know, can this thing really, does it really matter, because digital is going to be the tool for them? I mean, again, if someone, you know, a young person who doesn't have a lot of money really wants to get into film photography and they're willing to spend that money on it, like, you know, good for them, right? That's right. That's their thing. Why should they not have the, you know, everyone's going to have, you know, the digital is accessible to everyone. I mean, that's, you know, after a certain price point, it's there, right? You get the phone and you get everything with it, even the crappiest phone.
Right. And there's a lot of talk about how this is specifically geared around young people getting into these analog technologies. And at one point, I think it's in the Revenge of School part of it, Someone says that the baby boomers always worried about not seeing hip or cool, and so they jump headfirst into technology to try and stay with it. But the young people are moving back. And so you look on YouTube and there are these like On My Shelf videos popularized by author Ian Broom, and there are videos of people's vinyl collections and what they just picked up at the record store. There's a part in the book where you say, music became data, one more set of ones and zeros lurking in your hard drive, invisible to see and impossible to touch. Nothing is less cool than data. So has analog become the new old Instagram or the new old Facebook? It's this way of curating our lives in the best way for other people to see us?
I mean, I would definitely not compare it to Instagram or Facebook.
Well, no, but you know, if you watch a reveal video for a new Facebook feature, or especially with Apple products, you know, they show off photos and there are always these gorgeous photos of, you know, right, your friends on the ski trip. And it's like, I don't know any people who do this, and this isn't how my life is. So they project these... There's always talk about how people project the life they want you to see on social media. Right. Has analog sort of become like that in a way that we show off our vinyl collections or our bookshelves as a way to show people, look, we are as interesting as we say we are?
Well, I think that always was the case, right? I mean, why display these things in your house in an open area? You know, I was reading some meditation on this or some book about this. There was this great story in the New York Times this past weekend about books and bookstores. And it was, you know, the whole thing in the travel section, which was wonderful. And it was talking about some Roman senator or official or historian, like talking about someone else showing off their library of bound books, mm-hmm. Or manuscripts or whatever it was. You know, I think that that's always been there. I mean, that is, you know, the nature of kind of consumption, right? And you know, I look around my house now and the pictures that I have on my walls, I mean, why have any of this stuff? It is, you know, it's our way of projecting our personality through the things we acquire. And so that takes many forms, right? I mean, it's, what you're finding now is there is that interesting hybrid where, you know, people are again, like they're going out, they're buying books, they're collecting things, and then they're sharing that with that wider digital community to mm-hmm. get some sort of quantifiable likes on it or whatever. You know, what I found really interesting about this book, which I didn't have in my previous book, is like, there's been a lot of people like posting photos of it that they've sent me on social media, right? Here's your book. Like, here's your physical copy. You know, hey, I'm reading this. And it's like, it's, you know, it's that physical evidence, right?
Right.
I
did that too, actually. The, you know, certain pages that really spoke to me, I tweeted a picture.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's something to that. I think the thing about it, though, that's different with analog versus digital is that you could then, you know, if you encounter that in real life, if you were to come to my house, Harry, here in Toronto, you could go through my record collection and pull out a record and play it, and read the back. You can, you know, right. grab books off the bookshelf and look at them. And, you know, I might just send you home with one because if I really like it and think you'd like it too, right? You can't do that online. And so, you know, far from being sort of that larger social sharing, the beauty of analog is it actually is like that excuse for intimate interactions. You know, what's the point of buying a board game if you're not going to play with people?
Right.
And so I could do all the unboxing, you know, board game things or board game reviews I want on YouTube. But at the end of the day, what really matters is sitting down with people and actually playing it.
Right. I never understood the phenomenon of watching other people play video games. Even that seemed a little too far removed from social interaction for my taste.
Yeah. Unless it was in person, right? Where you're like right. sitting next to them while they tried to beat sort of the bonus level of Super Mario 3.
Right, exactly. And then you can backseat drive while they're there.
Exactly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nacht Sound Engineering. Nacht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nacht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nacht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nacht Sound Engineering today at nachtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nacht, more than a stack of tracks. In your discussion with Project Audio Systems founder Heinz, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Lichtenegger, you quote him as saying, magazines and newspapers were writing about vinyl and turntables, and our turntable business doubled from 2011 to 2014. So how much of that growth is due to word of mouth and general upturn in the industry, and how much is because of media outlets touting the resurgence of analog? Like, is there a chicken and egg scenario here where one is pushing the other?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big impetus for this was Record Store Day. So Record Store Day is an annual event that happens in April, and then now they have a Black Friday one as well, which is, you know, began in 2008 by a number of independent record stores around the U.S. that really just wanted like an excuse to get some publicity, because everybody was writing articles about the record store's dead, vinyl, you know, mm-hmm. you know, CD stores are dead. These things are dead. Forget it. It's all over. And they were saying, look, we're actually like still selling things. There's still a core of customers here. And so they created this thing, Record Store Days. You know, Warner Brothers, the label, was like, yeah, we'll put some you know, we'll give you some like new releases on vinyl or whatever. And now it's become this huge thing. There are thousands of record stores that participate all around the world, and it gets a tremendous amount of press. And that really drove the record store, drove the kind of narrative from the record store is dead to the record store is alive to now the record store keeps growing, and, you know, the record boom and the vinyl boom. And people read that, and, you know, what does it do? It lets them know that, you know, this is actually happening, that these retails are there, where they are, right, that these products are available. But I think more importantly, when people read these stories about, you know, record stores or, you know, board games or even, you know, film photography having this growth, it gives them permission, right? It moves it that much further into the mainstream. It gives them sort of a permission to say, this is acceptable. You're not a Luddite if you get into this. This is now part of the zeitgeist. This is where culture is going. This is sort of at the core of it. And so you are free to indulge in this, right? You know, suburban guy who's reading this in USA Today, not, you know, your Silver Lake or, you know, Brooklyn or Mission hipster, like, you know, dad in his 40s in the suburbs, you know, you could go and order that turntable on Amazon. Like, this is happening. And, you know, this is totally cool to do. This is acceptable.
Do you think we'll see that kind of media push? I mean, we do sort of see it for bookstores, but for every article about how independent bookstores are thriving, there are two more that come out saying bookstores are still dead and the Kindle is still growing and all that. Do you think we'll ever see that push for independent bookstores the way we've seen for the vinyl resurgence?
I think over the past year, that's really been apparent. You've seen it quite a lot. I've seen so much press around that. Mm-hmm. And that is all driven by, you know, numbers, right? It was the American Bookstore Association noted, you know, the growth in the sale of paper books for the first time in the past, you know, 5 years, as well as the growth in the number of bookstores. And so the media is going to report on that because it is a counter narrative to what is assumed is like the linear, endless, straight upward march of, you know, disruption, progress, and digital technology.
Right.
And so there's always going to be a fascination with that when, you know, the trend is a counter trend happens. So even if the Kindle kit still grows, like, but wait, people are still buying books and now the books are actually growing again. What's going on? There's a fascination around that. And then with that fascination, you get, you know, the sort of economic hard numbers explanation. Well, the profit margins on books are better for publishers and blah, 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 blah. But then what that does is it drives people to examine, well, why do people like this? Like, it's obviously it's happening. So what are the reasons behind it? And in those, in that type of coverage, you really get at the sort of essence and the cultural forces behind it. And I think that's what makes people realize, okay, well, yeah, maybe I should get back into books. Maybe I should go check out that new bookstore or the old one that's still there. You know, now it's, you know, the holiday season. So where else am I going to buy gifts?
And I was very interested to read about the way, I don't know if it was Book Culture or another bookstore, but that they were basically getting investments from the community to put this
Greenlight,
together.
Yeah.
Greenlight, that's so it.
Greenlight in Brooklyn, which just opened their second location last week.
That was so cool to read that people were doing that.
Yeah, and this was, you know, the two women who opened it, Jessica and Rebecca, were, I think it was in 2008 or 2009, so not an easy time for anyone to get, you know, financing. And then the banks, of course, said, no, what are you crazy? You're opening a bookstore now in the middle of a recession? You've got to be nuts. And so they essentially created a crowdfunding program, but actually real debt investing and not just some promise of some fake reward, where people were, you know, paid back with interest. They're investors, you know, they invested, the community invested, and the community believed in it. And there's been a number of other bookstores around the country where a similar thing has happened. And I think it's because, you know, there are some people who will invest in it because they read the numbers and they think, okay, well, this is just a, you know, there's growth in this business and there's, you know, a small but steady sort of profit to be made that, you know, work better for me than investing in bonds or whatever. And there are other people who, again, that romantic notion that we talked about, for them, that's a driving enough reason to put a couple thousand bucks behind it, because there is a benefit beyond just the financial one, and that is being in a community with the bookstore.
Yes. I think there is a definite plus to, I mean, if I were in a town that didn't have a bookstore, I would want to get one in there. I think it says a lot about a town that it values literature and reading and just the pursuit of intellect.
Mm-hmm. Ideas. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And jumping off this whole thing about the future of books and bookstores, you tell the story about a woman at a New York marketing agency when you tell her you're going to write this book, and she says, nobody reads books anymore. She wanted you to create this branded content that maybe you could partner with a company like Kodak or whoever. So how do you handle someone who essentially tells you the work you've been doing isn't worth anything, and that it's only going to be worth something if you do these like 2-minute videos you can watch on mute on Facebook?
That was a very interesting, like, infuriating and yet ultimately revealing conversation, because it was kind of like, oh, hey, you know, your book's really interesting. This is my last book. You know, if you're ever in New York, come meet for coffee. And we're talking about some sort of branded content series around food. I was like, okay, fine. Met this person for coffee and we were talking, and I said this. I was like, well, that, you know, it was such a direct challenge. And I don't think she meant it. She didn't mean it any malicious way. She was very smart, nice person, very opinionated. But it was such a direct challenge to what I was doing, not just the idea around the book, but like the idea of writing books in general.
Right.
And it's a hard thing, right? Like this book has been with me almost as a full-time job for over 2 years, and it's still not done. I'm still hustling and, you know, now doing interviews and writing articles and trying to sell it even after it's come out. And it is a very, it's a difficult thing to keep that motivation and sort of remember why you're doing it. And of course, there's always, you know, and then when you hear in the world of like digital marketing people and ad agency people, it's like, it's all about 30-second video clips. It's all about 12-second GIFs. It's all about, you know, what's your Pokemon Go strategy? If you don't have a Pokemon Go strategy, your brand is useless. And I think, you know, the thing with digital is it's so fast moving and there's such a potential for massive hits, and everybody's so scared of being left behind that they jump from thing to thing to thing, you know, especially big brands and companies that are being led by ad agencies. They'll dive from thing to thing to thing, when the reality is at the end of the day, the good stuff, the quality work, you know, the creative material, whether it's books, whether it's movies, whether it's newspapers, whether it's, you know, the work that people are doing, the good stuff, the stuff that people put time into, that's what lasts. That's what endures. And ultimately, that's what wins.
A little later on, you quote Stephen Watson, who founded the magazine subscription service Stack. I want to go a little bit more into this publishing and book writing topic. And he talked about blogging and the inevitable move to self, how this relates to self-publishing full-length books. And he says, people blogged and they grew up with blogs and writing as a form of self-expression. Now the same people want to be in print, so their ideas are legitimate. I know a lot of self-published authors who swear that they don't care if they're ever seen in print, that they ever get on a Barnes & Noble bookshelf. It doesn't matter to them. They just want to get their books out there. But do you see that as being a true statement, that they don't care at all, or that an ebook is as much a, quote, real book as a print one?
You know, for me, no. Personally. Right. I can only speak personally.
Right.
For me, no. I think what Stephen was talking about there is that, you know, the people who are creating new magazines today, the magazines that he distributes on Stack, which for your listeners, is essentially a subscription service and that you subscribe to for, I don't know, $200 a year. And every month they will send you a new independent magazine. Could be a travel magazine from Britain called Serial. It could be Kinfolk, which is kind of like the Martha Stewart of hipsters. It could be a really strange magazine out of Germany about redheads, or one about coffee culture. And again, all these magazines are new and they are growing. They're not huge, but you know, some of them, you know, might sell a couple thousand copies. Some of them might sell, you know, more than 100,000 copies. And what's interesting is that every single one of them is being created and written by and photographed and designed and sold to young consumers, right? People in their 30s, people in their 20s. And so what he's saying is, you know, this is the same generation that started off communicating digitally, and for them it was publishing, you know, blogs or whatever. But like, there's a limit to that. You reach a point, I think, for a lot of these people, but not all, where, yeah, I can write anything and hit click and they'll be up on the web and that's awesome. Then what, right? Like, there is a certain satisfaction to the finality of a printed product, right? You asked me to read from the book, so I pulled out a copy. I don't usually have it sitting around. I'm holding my book in my hands right now. And, you know, that brings me some sort of sense of satisfaction. When I first got these back from the printer and the box arrived at my house and I opened it up, you know, that there was real definite kind of pride of like, okay, I did this. I've gotten this far. I got this real, actual thing out in the world. Trees died so that my ideas may live.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think it's for all communications. I don't think it's for everyone. So yeah, I think again, like, the especially for generations that have grown up or begun their careers largely in you know, online, the world of digital communications, there is an added attraction. It's almost a renewed attraction to something physical, right? It's a novelty now. It's a, you know, only the books that really are the ones that, like, you know, reach a certain level are worthy of the printed page. They don't just print every book these days.
That's how I feel. I'm a writer. I've written 4.5 novels, and every time I finish one, not only do I print it out on a laser printer to edit it, but I also, once the final draft is done, I print a copy through CreateSpace or Lulu or whichever it is to hold a physical copy of a paperback in my hand, just to know what it would feel like. Even if it never gets published, I will at least have a copy of my book in my hand. And what you're talking about seems to go full circle. You know, the age group that has grown up on the internet and that has grown up with digital note taking and digital music and nothing to hold, nothing, no physical object to hold, everything's been digitized, that they're seeking out these avenues to write in notebooks to hold their notes and to buy vinyl to hold their music. It's interesting that it's going full circle now.
Well, and I think it just goes down to the nature of the human experience, right? Like, we are physical creatures. We live in a world where we touch and hold things. And so you take those things away. And initially it's like, well, great. I don't have to carry that. That's amazing. Wow. That's so convenient. Look at all the shelf space that I have. And then after a while you're like, what the hell am I going to put on these shelves?
Yeah.
Like, I can't, you know, how can I go to Harry's birthday party and bring him another gift card?
Hey, if it's for Barnes & Noble, I'll take it.
There you go.
But there's also the serendipity aspect of it. You know, I found one of my guests, Jeff Mano, who wrote A Burglar's Guide to the City. I found him because I stumbled upon his book on a table at Barnes & Noble, flipping through articles and magazines. Stack, like you say, I might get a magazine in the mail that I never would have bought on my own because it was just part of the rotation.
And that's the idea.
Exactly.
Right? That's sort of what you sign up for. I mean, I did a great interview last week with a journalist based in Madrid for El Independiente, which is the big sort of national newspaper of one of the big, you know, two big national newspapers of Spain. And she, you know, found out about my book because she was on vacation in San Francisco a few weeks ago and went to visit City Lights, the famous bookstore there, mm-hmm. where I had my book event a few days before and had signed a bunch of copies that they had displayed by the cash register. And she writes about tech and she's like, oh, cool. And, you know, we had this fantastic conversation in Spanish, no less, over the course of an hour. And she wrote this wonderful article that I read the other day. And, you know, I think there was at one time, you know, the promise of the internet was that you would, you know, because you were connected to anyone, anywhere in the world, there was, you know, this incredible potential to find all sorts of random stuff. But, you know, over time, as it's become so central to our lives, and especially the power of social media has increased, you know, to such a central place, you know, two things have happened to kind of lessen that and almost take it in the opposite direction. One of them is just the sheer scale and amount of stuff. Like it is just a, you know, a stream, like a just a gushing waterfall of content, right? Like there's just so much stuff there that you just kind of don't even like, you can't even process. You just
right.
glaze over it. It's just firing at you. Articles, stories, pictures, brrr. Like just, you know, just a constant, you know, a diarrhea of information, to use a horrible term. And then the other thing is, you know, then it is refined by these feedback loops, you know, created by algorithms where, oh, you like David Sacks' book, The Revenge of Analog, then here's 10 other books. Like, then you must like only books about, you know, this right. sort of stuff. And then you never, you know, your window gets increasingly smaller. And that thing that's totally from left field would never find you. You know, one of the great things I really liked about this book was when I would be in a record store doing interviews or, you know, bookstores in New York doing interviews. And I would always ask for recommendations for things. I want to get, you know, what's a good record to get like from here? What's a good local band? Or, you know, do you have any, you know, what are some good books for, you know, my kid or my friend or whoever? And, you know, a lot of the stuff was surprising and not the normal thing that you would expect and not something that, you know, the Spotify or Amazon algorithm would spit out. And it's that randomness, the serendipity of it that makes the analog experience, you know, rewarding in a very different way, right? It's the reward of a surprise of the unknown versus, yeah. you know, the predictable.
It's why I still listen to terrestrial radio too. As much as I love podcasts and Spotify and Apple Music and all that, I still love listening and finding new things just by hearing them on the radio. You lose that serendipity when you pay attention only to like the Amazon algorithms that say, well, if you like The Revenge of Analog, here are 8 other books on stationery and pencils that you might like.
Yeah. And one thing I've come to realize, I think I realized it more with like the e-commerce and shopping, but increasingly I think it's across, you know, online, is like the internet and that digital world works best when you know what you want, right? I want to find X, boom, you can find it quicker, cheaper, better than anything else. But if you don't know what you want, and you're looking for something in more general sense, you know, it is terrible. It's just so vast. And it is so, you know, your means of accessing it is the size of your screen and whatever keywords you can punch into a browser, whatever interface is there. So like, you can't just go shopping online like you can in a Saturday afternoon in a city or even in a mall, right? You can't just go, I'm going to spend a few hours browsing online shopping. It's like, well, what do you want? I want a hat. Here's every hat ever made. You know, but you can walk the mall and near where you live in New Jersey or on the street here in Toronto and, you know, walk by a store and see a hat. Or you're like, okay, I know these three stores have hats. I'm going to walk between them. I'm going to stop for lunch. I'm going to find something. Oh, wow. I didn't even know there was a hat here. Oh, wow. That's a great hat. I'm going to get that one. But it also has a sweater here. Like, whereas, you know, online is very, it's like you have to be definitive and it rewards that much more. And I think the analog world, because it is human scale, again, is a much more fluid experience and allows just sort of aimless wandering in a much more rewarding way, where, you know, the aimless wandering is the reward itself, right? Walking on the street, looking at the hats, looking, you know, at the stores is the experience. It's more so than just the sort of hunt for the particular item or the transaction of the commerce.
Right. And it goes against, like, you and I agree on this, and I know there are other people who enjoy hand recommendations and hand selling of certain things, but it goes against what big data tells us about how people don't like going shopping. They don't like driving to the store and standing in checkout lines and talking to other people just to buy whatever thing they're looking for or not looking for. So it's interesting to see this resurgence of analog retail, especially when it's coming from places like Amazon, to see this resurgence when all we've been told for the last 15, 20 years is, no, all the retail is going to be done online. Nobody wants to talk to anybody anymore.
Right, right. And you know, it'll be interesting to see what Amazon does with its, you know, Uber of grocery stores. I mean, one of the interesting things that I found in the research, which I may have ended up cutting from the book, I can't recall, but it was about, you know, those automated checkout kiosks in supermarkets. You know, you would like scan the stuff yourself and then, you know, put it in. And they said that like a lot of big supermarket chains ended up ripping them out and replacing them with cashiers because, you know, people liked having the cashier there. So I think that there is something of like, you know, there's a Joni Mitchellism going on here, which is, you know, you with the digital world, you really sometimes don't know what you got until it's gone.
Yeah.
Or the analog world, right? And it's like, okay, you don't need your physical music anymore. That's awesome. I don't need to like collect CDs or have records. Look at all the space I've seen. I can listen to this anywhere. Man, I really miss touching stuff though. And like, you know, that is, you know, if that's the nostalgia that we talked about in the beginning that becomes the driving force, then that is, it is, you know, something that is realized only after it no longer is the default and the necessity.
Right. And it doesn't have to be either or. I think a lot of people see this as a binary issue that, well, if you love analog, then you don't like Kindles or you don't like Spotify. And, you know, if I'm in the car, I don't want to schlep 30 CDs with me. And at the same time, if I'm going on a flight, I don't want to take 3 or 4 hardcovers with me. I would want a Kindle that I can take instead. So, you know, it really does come down to your situation. What is it you're willing to sacrifice and when?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, there's very few people who are dogmatic about it in that way, right? And it, you know, I read most of my news online, right? I subscribe to the New York Times digital edition because I can't even think about reading an entire physical newspaper every day, and it's very expensive. But you know, I have my magazine subscriptions in paper that I will not give up. I will not give up my subscription to The Economist. I'll not give up a subscription to The New Yorker and Dwell and whatever the hell else I have, because they'll bring me a degree of pleasure, right? That's so much more than just the information in them. And part of that is the things we talked about, the serendipity, the articles I would read about things I would never even click through online. So again, I think it is, you know, that's why everyone's like, well, this will, but then once the technology gets good enough, this whole analog thing will go away. It's like, it's not a question of that. It is a question of people finding that right balance of technology in their lives and where analog and digital can sort of mix and work together and coincide and complement each other.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. We don't have a whole lot of time left, and there's one big topic I wanted, well, it's technically two big topics I wanted to talk about. And you have these two chapters that are back to back. It's The Revenge of Work and The Revenge of School. And in The Revenge of Work, there's...
Sounds like an Alice Cooper song.
Yeah. There are a few passages about how the higher income demographic are better prepared for jobs in technology like Twitter and Facebook because they tend to come from an upbringing that has given them the push they needed, the boost they needed to get there. They've come from school districts where they had access to technology and they were brought up with it. But in a population like Detroit, where 47% of it, as it said in the book, is functionally illiterate, and so they aren't prepared for those kinds of jobs. So why would a Twitter or a Facebook or a Google bring jobs there anyway? There's a definite race and class gap going on. On the flip side of it, on the school part of it, you talk about how technology and education doesn't make learning easier or better. It doesn't elevate student performance. It doesn't boost anything in any substantial way. And yet schools throw so much money at technology in education. So if the new jobs are leaning toward tech, how do we prepare lower income students for these jobs that are increasingly leaning toward the Google and Twitter and the coding? How do we prepare these kids for jobs if throwing technology at them isn't going to do anything?
Well, I think it's a question of, first of all, you know, how you throw technology at them, right? So right. What I build the argument against in that chapter on education is the notion that, you know, well, the economy is increasingly digital and work is increasingly, you know, done through digital means. So, you know, school should be too. And that means everything from, you know, math to reading to drama class has to be done with the aid of computers in some way, shape, or form. And that by introducing, you know, computers in some way, shape, or form to any subject or any type of schooling environment, you will therefore improve, you know, name a measure, marks, schooling, you know, educational inequality between poor kids and wealthy kids, black kids and white kids, you know, third world kids and kids in the OECD, whatever, right? And time and again, people in the world of ed tech have sort of pushed that narrative. Mm-hmm. And time and again, the results have come back and shown that it isn't. And I think we have to make a very clear distinction between tech and education for the sake of just putting tech there because it looks good or it sounds cool. And that's, you know, every kid should get an iPad at the school. Well, why? How would that actually work? How does that make it actually better? Can you show us the evidence that actually does? And what actually does matter, which is like, okay, we need to teach every kid the fundamentals of computer science and like coding 101 as, you know, a requirement in all secondary schools. And that is, you know, educating about technology and computers and engineering and you know, how to write code should be a necessary skill because those technologies are central to, you know, economic life and the world going forward and will only increase. But I think that often gets confused with, hey, look, we just bought a bunch of cool touch screens for your school. Like, look at us. We're pushing towards the future where that actually does nothing. It's sort of done for optics. You know, on the economic front, I think there's also something there, which is this idea that, well, the jobs are increasingly going and, you know, to things that are involving computers or not. Therefore, anything else is kind of worthless. And there's two problems with that. One is that we still make things. We still need things. There are still lots of opportunities for people up and down the income chain who are not doing things related to tech or sort of creating computers. And the other thing is like the tech sector, while significant economically, is not a huge employer, right? The whole idea behind it is that you can achieve these huge efficiencies by the computers doing a lot of the work, right? And so, you know, companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google are really small employers. Like they're not big and they tend to only really employ highly trained, highly educated people. So, you know, it's not like everybody's going to be able to get to work there. It's only going to be the kind of top people who in any economy would be working somewhere good and doing absolutely fine. It would have been, you know, NASA in the 60s and the car companies and engineering companies in the 80s and 90s. And you know, now it's the tech companies, right? Or Wall Street, I guess, for a couple of years.
Yeah, there is that. But all these jobs that, you know, people do need to make things, these jobs are disappearing. They're going overseas, they're going to Mexico. And also, yes, these large these tech companies are some of the largest in the world and some of the smallest employers, and yet they have some of the biggest impact on the communities where they are. The homeless population in San Francisco is out of hand, and also in New York and Austin, it's the displacement is growing. You know, houses, 700 square foot houses are going for $3,000 a month in Austin because of the tech boom going on down there.
And so it's the, you know, there was this notion that I think started in the 90s, really, with the first big tech boom and the internet boom, which was just like, well, as long as we just encourage enough tech and, you know, make our city a tech city, everything will be good. Like, that's the way of it is. And I think, you know, you get tremendous benefits from it, whether you're a business, whether you're a community, whether you're an institution. But it's not without its drawbacks. And I think, again, that same balance that we talked about, analog and digital in our personal lives, on a much bigger societal level, is something that we really need to look at, because we can't just say, okay, the only economy we cared about is the knowledge economy, the digital economy, the internet economy, and, you know, we're going to just focus on that, because you're just going to leave a huge chunk of society behind.
Right. And at some point, you're going to flood the market. If you keep pushing kids to STEM and coding, you know, just teach them to code and they'll be set for life. Well, at some point, we're not going to need any more coders. We're going to have plenty of coders, and we're not going to have electricians or plumbers or people to fabricate things for us.
Exactly. Or other things. I mean, I think about, like, when you think about the countries that are like, you know, like engineering is like the top thing, and it's like India and China, right? It's like, you know, the big schools are the engineering schools, and everybody comes out of it and is like, joins the Communist Party and becomes a member of the Politburo as an engineer. Like, there is something about that society that just values that sort of hard skill. That's a bigger, wider debate. But again, I think it's this, you know, you still want people to be able to like print books and sell books and make things. And maybe they're making it for a market that's not going to be a mass market, but a niche market. But you know what? People will pay $20 for that notebook, and you can employ, you know, 20 people's marketing and designing and creating those $20 notebooks, and that can sustain them and their families and healthcare and, you know, whatever. Then that's how you build a society, right? It can't all just be, you know, the big answer, the big magical answer.
That's true. There was an article I saw this morning in Scotland about the Amazon warehouse near there. I don't remember what the year, if it was Glastonbury or something, but the workers at the warehouse were actually living in tents close to the warehouse, because in the freezing weather, mind you, because they are charged £10 a day to commute back and forth due to the shuttle system they have there. And so you have these real skill jobs of fulfilling distributions at a warehouse, and yet they're being screwed over by the tech companies that have put them out, you know, in the first place.
Yeah, there's some real Upton Sinclair stuff going on. I mean, you know, it's, again, it's like, what is the price that you pay for that, right?
How much is your free shipping really worth?
Well, that's it. No such thing as free.
Yeah, exactly. There was one more thing I wanted to talk about, which is you talk about the loss of empathy due to our reliance on digital technology. And I'd like to talk about that in relation to the recent U.S. election and the echo chambers that we have built for ourselves in digital technology. You know, on Twitter, you can block whoever you don't want to hear from. You can follow whoever you do want to hear from. So how do we broaden our worldview in the case of current events without legitimizing the people whose views shouldn't be legitimized, like the racists and the bigots and the white supremacists?
The Nazis.
Nazis.
They're back.
It truly is springtime for Hitler.
Yeah, exactly. That is a vastly more complicated question than I think anybody's even prepared to answer these days. But I think you're not gonna solve this online, right?
Right.
You're not gonna click your way out of it. You're not gonna click your way to understanding or comment your way to make someone understand you.
Right. They call it slacktivism.
Slacktivism, right? Like, there is, you know, there was this notion that was born a couple of years ago that, you know, beginning of the Obama administration, I think with the change.org, the success of that, like, this was the future. And then there was this idea that they could export that social media driven activism around the world. And, you know, the first time that was kind of tested was the Green Revolution in Iran, when, you know, it was a Twitter revolution against Ahmadinejad and all the repression and so forth. And like, yeah, it was great and all, but you know, the other side had bullets. And, right. And then it was, you know, the Arab Spring was the next thing. And again, it was like, well, you know, at the end of the day that, you know, the real, like you can't just, you know, I'm making a big jump here, but again, I think there's this notion of, well, we can build an app that teaches empathy, or we can do, you know, what is that going to come from? It's going to come from the real relationships with people. It's going to come from real friendships where there's real consequence, which doesn't exist online. And so,
right. The Dakota Access Pipeline wasn't stopped with a hashtag. It was stopped because thousands of people showed up to stop it.
Right. And yes, they got known in many ways because people talked about them online. But, you know, at the end of the day, the things of consequence that still happen are happen in the real world.
My final question for you, has writing this book changed the way you approach your creative process and the way you write and collect research and everything?
In some ways, yeah. I think, you know, the biggest one was that the brainstorming process became much more visual. You know, I had a wall filled with sticky notes. And you know, every draft of the book that I would finish, I would print out as you do and go through it with a pen. Because I found that I just saw it in a way that was totally different from editing on, you know, Microsoft Word. And so I wasn't banging the thing out on a typewriter, but you know, that became central to what I was doing. And I think, again, it provides a different perspective. It slows down the process. It changes the process in a way. Even if fundamentally the majority of that process is going to be digital, those analog moments and components, you know, change it. And that brings a different result. And I think you have to do that.
I couldn't agree more. And if you ever do want to write your next book on a typewriter, I have one here. I actually sold my first iPad to buy a typewriter.
You're a man after my own heart.
there's a great place. I don't know if you were familiar with it. They're a printer repair shop, but it's a typewriter store right across from the Flatiron in New York. And they have a picture of Tom Hanks hanging up on the wall. He gets all his typewriters repaired there. So I went in one day and I had $300 and said, I want that one. And they sent me home with a 1950s Smith Corona.
I'm waiting for someone to, I know a few people who are talking about doing kind of a new typewriter company.
Oh, wow. Would be.
Yeah. So I hope some of this that'll happen in the next few years. I can't imagine it wouldn't.
It has to. I mean, I see typewriter iPad keyboards. So I figure the regular typewriter is just around the corner. I think Olivetti is still making typewriters, like new typewriters. There you go.
Cool.
So David, thank you so much for coming on. This has been fantastic.
My pleasure, Harry. Thanks so much.
Where can people find you?
Here at home.
Snakes and lattes?
In the truest analog sense, yeah. Just knock on my door. Yeah, online, I guess, at Twitter. In the pages, in the book. Find me in the pages of the book, the real book.
Excellent. This has been Covered with special guest David Sachs. Links to David's books and all other materials discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. Thank you for listening. If you liked today's show, I would love it if you took a few minutes to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes so other book lovers can better find us. And if your podcast listening app of choice gives you the ability to recommend us, please do. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can do so by supporting the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth, hosting costs, and equipment upgrades. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Nox Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.